This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, like President Bush, is facing criticism that his government hyped intelligence about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction to justify going to war. My guest Peter Stothard was given special access to Blair just before and during the war. Beginning March 10th, Stothard spent 30 days with Blair at 10 Downing Street and war summits around the world. Stothard's new book is called 30 Days. A shorter journal of those days was first published in the Times of London. Stothard is the former editor of the paper and current editor of the Times Literary Supplement. Under investigation now is the probable suicide of David Kelly, a British advisor on weapons of mass destruction and a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He was found dead on Friday. The BBC says that Kelly was the primary source for their report in late May that said the Blair government exaggerated the threat of WMD, particularly in stating that Iraq could deploy those weapons within 45 minutes of a command to do so. Kelly admitted that he was a source for the report, but denied that he discussed the 45-minute issue. He testified before a House of Commons committee 3 days before his death. I asked Peter Stothard about the impact of this story on the Blair government.
Well, it's a very serious allegation for the Prime Minister and his staff, because it suggested that they had taken intelligence data, didn't find it interesting enough, and had somehow persuaded the intelligence services to add material to make it kind of sexier, more interesting. The Prime Minister took very, very deeply and bitterly against the accusation that he'd done that, because he was absolutely certain that it wasn't true. And therefore he had every reason to, and his staff had every reason to be very hostile to whoever in the government had been the source of this information. Now, it was one of those little media squalls, which was a bit of a sideshow to all the big things that were going on, but it rapidly became the main show. And of course, now, you know, once the show has a dead body on the floor, it's absolutely the main show. And so the Prime Minister, who, you know, earlier this week was basking in glory in Washington and getting standing ovations, is now in really serious difficulties on this one.
Tony Blair has called for a judicial inquiry into the death of David Kelly. What's at stake for Blair in this story?
Well, there'd be very high stakes for Tony Blair throughout. He was absolutely convinced that that what he was doing in taking Britain into war alongside the United States was correct, and he was prepared to take an enormous amount of flak there. You know, for 30 days, I watched him do just that. But he's also been absolutely certain that what he did in relation to presenting the intelligence data before the war was all true and okay. I think maybe in retrospect they're wondering whether they perhaps should have released so much, but you know, he was confident that what he did was right, and he certainly didn't want an inquiry into it. And certainly, I think before I left England, it was made quite clear to me Tony Blair would quit, I think, rather than allow an inquiry into the handling of the WMD issue in the run-up to the war. But of course, a death changes everything, and now there's an inquiry into the circumstances surrounding David Kelly's death, and it's hard to think that that inquiry won't go quite a long way into looking at the way in which the WMD evidence was put before the war, absolutely what the Prime Minister didn't want.
President Bush is in the middle of a controversy now over 16 words in one of his speeches. And those 16 words are: the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Now, the Bush administration is, of course, attributing this information to the British and saying, we cited the British intelligence for this. How are the British taking this? Do they feel like they're being put into the position of being the fall guy?
No, I don't think this is very well understood over here. The British simply stand by that story. I mean, all that the British say is that the Saddam Hussein was attempting to buy uranium in Africa. Now, if someone from the CIA goes to Niger and finds that he has confidence in the Niger systems and that he can find no evidence that Saddam was trying to buy uranium, well, that doesn't seem to the British to in any way contradict their view from other sources that he was trying to buy it. Nor, I think, would the CIA argue the contrary. It's just that two sources say different things, and that the British are very, very confident of their source.
When you first got to 10 Downing Street on March 10th to write your piece, the atmosphere was already turning against Tony Blair and against the war. There were demonstrations outside of 10 Downing Street. What was it like to be inside while all these demonstrations were taking place outside?
It was a very extraordinary experience. I've been to Downing Street before, many times as a newspaper editor and as a political journalist, but I never saw anything like I saw on that first day. Tony Blair was doing what he called his masochism strategy. He was going around TV studios, facing people who hated him, hated his policies, were calling him a war criminal, a child murderer, and worse. And he was being slow-hand clapped and, frankly, kind of humiliated day after day. And a lot of his advisors thought, this is terrible. You know, no British prime minister, certainly no American president would ever do something like that. But Tony Blair had decided that what he was going to do in Iraq was right. And he saw this extraordinary sort of virtue in knocking his head against a brick wall, trying to persuade people that what he was going to do was right and their view of it was wrong. And I talked to him a lot about this. I said, look, you know, why are you doing this? You know, you're not changing anybody's mind, are you? And he said, no, but I want it to be absolutely clear after this is over that I tried to change people's minds. You know, I sincerely believe that the world changed after 9/11, that there's a totally different threat to our generation of leaders than there were before. A lot of people don't agree with me, and I'm determined to do everything I can to make sure that as many as possible of them do believe in me.
You know, demonstrators want to believe that their demonstration is going to affect their leaders and help change the minds of their leaders. Did you have any impression at all that the demonstrations were having any effect on what Tony Blair and his advisors were planning? Was it getting to them?
Yes. Must be very frustrating for the demonstrators who are very, very close to Downing Street. You can get a lot closer to Downing Street than you can get to the White House. You know, Tony Blair only had to open a window or go out on the balcony. You can hear this roar of people shouting, Tony, 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 out, out, out. So you'd have thought it ought to get to him. But I have to report that he was absolutely committed and was not wobbling at all. I never saw any sense or heard of any sense that he was ever looking around him, looking at the millions of people in the streets and saying, well, you know, those millions of people are right and I am wrong. And that absolute bedrock fixed position was what really gave the confidence to his staff, this tiny group of staff that were running everything. I mean, it was a very odd sight of government in action. A man who'd made up his mind, a tiny number of people who were helping him to put that decision into practice, and this vast army of protesters at the gates, and a rather sort of sullen support from his political colleagues who came in and out of Downing Street as though they were running the government, although they knew, of course, that they weren't running the government at all.
You were at 10 Downing Street when Tony Blair was preparing his speech before Parliament, urging the ministers to vote for war with Iraq. You observed a little bit of the editing process. What did you see as his aides helped him formulate the speech?
I think it would surprise Americans the extent to which it was done in an extraordinary rush. You know, Tony Blair wrote the speech himself, the sort of outlines of it. I was with him when he did it on one Saturday afternoon in Downing Street. He doesn't have professional speech writers. He wrote the speech out in longhand in blue ink. It was then given to various people to make comments on. And when we met him again in the House of Commons just before the speech was to be produced, huge sections of it were totally up in the air. There was a whole section, for instance, on appeasement. You know, would it be a good idea to compare Saddam Hussein to Hitler and to attack the opponents of this war as the appeasers of Hitler? This was a big sort of philosophical history lesson issue amongst his advisors and in Britain and in the press at that time. And you could argue about it all day. But suddenly, with only 20 minutes to go to make this speech, we were still arguing about it. I mean, he was saying, well, should it go in? Should it go out? You know, should we water it down? Should we sort of hype it up? And in fact, when he went into the House of Commons chamber, there was still uncertain exactly whether he was going to use that bit or not. I mean, the House of Commons is a real bear pit, and you've got to think on your feet, and you just need sort of speech notes, really. And that was, frankly, all he had. Nothing like the sort of set-piece speech that you're used to in a State of the Union address or something like that. It was all being put together at the last minute by instinct, and the only person responsible for it is the Prime Minister himself. It's a very remarkable sight to see.
And how did the speech go?
There were two views of the speech. On the outside, everybody said it was a complete triumph, and the newspaper headlines were very positive. I have to say, in Tony Blair's office where I was, he came back and everybody seemed very deflated. Of course, they knew all the lines, they'd heard them before, and they knew that the real job to be done was not the speech itself, which was now over, but trying to persuade dozens and dozens of Labour MPs who weren't persuaded that they should support the Prime Minister. And it was at that moment, just as the real hard political arm-twisting was about to begin, that the White House called and started asking, you know, was it okay if we started the war now? And at that moment, the whole the balloon really did go up in the Prime Minister's office. I've never seen those guys so sort of shocked and nervous.
So how did Blair's people respond to Bush's people when the Bush administration made the phone call?
Well, I was in the room, and Alistair Campbell, who is not an easy man to embarrass or get too excited, and he said to the White House, well, if you could just hold it till we've got this thing out of the way, it would be very helpful.
Were there calls from the European Union, from leaders of the European Union, while you were at 10 Downing Street? And could you get a sense, if so, of what those calls were like?
Yeah, Downing Street divided the world into two sections, the real world and the unreal world. And the real world is the United States and Iraq and Mideast. The unreal world, in their sort of insider joke, is the European Union. Jacques Chirac was right at the forefront of the argument in those first few days. I mean, Tony Blair had good relations with Jacques Chirac. There was a picture on Tony Blair's wall of Jacques Chirac with the baby Leo Blair and Bill Clinton in the picture too. All very, very good fun and hugger-mugger. But when it was clear that Chirac was going to stop any attempts to get the second resolution through the UN, suddenly there was a great sort of freezing in relations between Britain and particularly France. Gerhard Schroeder, slightly different. They had dinner together on, I think, the third night that I was there. Schroeder in a very embarrassing position because, of course, he'd said he'd support President Bush and then had changed his mind when the German electorate didn't seem to like it very much. So President Bush angry with Schroeder. Blair trying to patch it up because Schroeder is kind of a bit more like Bill Clinton as far as Blair's concerned. He's a kind of friendly, you know, pat you on the back guy. But the real ice was between Blair and Chirac, and I watched them in the corridors in Brussels. Extraordinary confrontation, which seemed at one point as though it was going to end in a terrible sort of diplomatic rift, but gradually pieced itself together to become just about sort of holding the show on the road. A lot of very, very tense diplomats, and including the German Chancellor, watching as Tony Blair spoke to Jacques Chirac after the first British casualties had been announced, and at the first meeting that they'd had to be together since he decided that he would veto that second resolution. That was a high tension diplomacy for those who like that kind of thing.
My guest is Peter Stothard, author of 30 Days, Tony Blair and the Test of History. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Stothard. He's the editor of the Times Literary Supplement, former editor of the Times of London. For 30 days, he was able to stay in 10 Downing Street observing Tony Blair. He wrote a piece on that for the Times of London, and now he's expanded that into a book called 30 Days, and the 30 Days started on March 10th, just before the war in Iraq. After the war officially began, Tony Blair was preparing his speech to tell the British public about the war. And he was considering ending his speech with "God bless you." That was a very controversial end within 10 Downing Street. What was the controversy that you observed over that ending?
It was an extraordinary moment. I'd never seen the entire group around Tony Blair rise up as one, you know, to attack the Prime Minister in the way that they did over that. At the time, the Prime Minister is a fairly conventionally religious man by British standards. I thought he would have had no problem whatsoever, as indeed with large numbers of the British people, with ending a speech with "God bless you." But of course his political aides knew that in the context of this war and the way this war was being understood, any suggestion that could allow people to say that this war was being fought for religious purposes, you know, was some kind of crusade, was sort of hostile to Muslims, was absolute dynamite, and he shouldn't do it. So, but Tony Blair took a great deal of persuading. You know, he said, "Look, you know, I want to end 'God bless you.'" And then they said, "No, people don't want chaplains stuffing stuff down their throats." And Tony Blair was quite affronted by this and said, "You're a godless lot, aren't you?" And then there was a Jewish guy who was one of the aides to Alistair Campbell. He said, "Count me out. You know, I'm not godless." And then somebody else shouted, "That's not the same God." And then Tony Blair came in with, "Yes, it is the same God." And here we were. There was a call to President Bush waiting. We had a motorcade downstairs to take us off to Brussels. I remember Cherie Blair, the Prime Minister's wife, was trying to get out and was blocked by a BBC camera van. It was a complete sort of, you know, everybody was on high alert, high tension. And there we were having this kind of philosophical, theological discussion about whether the Jewish and Christian gods are the same or not.
So finally, Blair did not end the speech with "God bless you."
No, I'm afraid he didn't. He ended it with a very lame thank you. And you could almost tell from the tone of his voice when he was delivering that speech that he sort of somehow felt he'd been talked out of something that he really wanted to do.
Now, let me ask you about another thing that you observed in your 30 days of observing Tony Blair. You accompanied Tony Blair to a castle in Northern Ireland where President Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell came. Do you feel like you were able to get any insights into the relationship between George Bush and Tony Blair?
Yes, I think so. It's a business-like relationship. I mean, Blair and Clinton had this buddy-buddy relationship. You can almost see them when they were in a room together. They had their arms around each other. Always looked as though they would, you know, go out for a drink, have dinner, talk about the third way politics for the world, you know, till midnight. Bush and Blair really quite different. I watched them particularly at Hillsborough Castle. They were standing against an iron gate. And behind it was the world's biggest rhododendron tree, so it made quite a beautiful sight. But there was always at least a yard between them, a whole sort of half a gate between these two people as they talked. And Bush would talk in wide gestures, great expansive gestures, and we know from the aides around him that at that stage he had this very sort of broad sense of the way in which things would go after the war. The British were much more cautious. Tony Blair would always make little step-like movements with his hands, suggesting that, look, you know, if you're going to rebuild Iraq, if you're going to have a Middle East peace process, if you're going to really get the benefits that can come from this successful military action, you've got to take it step by step within the international community. And you could see these two guys arguing about this, but it was all done in a very business-like, sort of CEO to CEO style way. And I think the British came to respect George Bush because although, you know, Blair and Clinton were great mates, they didn't always find that the deals that they'd done or thought they'd done would sort of stick when everybody was sort of remembering or making the notes the next morning. Whereas I think they got the impression and still have the impression with George Bush that if you make a deal with George Bush, that it will stick and then he will stay by it. And that's perhaps a better way, if perhaps a less immediately sort of friend-to-friend way of conducting international business.
One last question. Some of Blair's critics in England have said that Tony Blair behaved like he's George Bush's poodle. Did you get a sense of whether that gets to Tony Blair?
Tony Blair's become much tougher. One of the things that surprised me going back into Downing Street for 30 days, having not been there for a little while before, was just how much thicker-skinned he'd become. He's taken some big knocks from the media. So the stuff he's taking at the moment, I mean, at least he's kind of he's prepared for it emotionally, psychologically. So when people call him President Bush's poodle, well, that's quite kind compared to some of the other things that they're calling him. I mean, it's difficult for a British Prime Minister, always has been. It was difficult with Thatcher and Reagan. You know, it was difficult even with Churchill and Eisenhower. You always, we are close allies. We do see a lot of things the same way. British Prime Ministers often exaggerate their closeness to American presidents. Churchill did, Macmillan did, even Thatcher may have done a bit. I think Tony Blair is quite keen not to do that. He doesn't want to pretend a closeness with America that he doesn't have. Equally well, he knows that any British Prime Minister is inevitably going to be called by anti-Americans and Europeans who have a totally different view of the world, America's poodle, and that's, you know, it goes with the territory.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Stothard is the author of 30 Days, Tony Blair and the Test of History. He's the editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.